Hey, everyone. On this week's episode of 6 Degrees with Mike McKenna, I'm joined by Ray Barilli, the head athletic trainer of the 2019 Stanley Cup champion St. Louis Blues. Ray has spent over 20 seasons in the National Hockey League, worked 2 Olympic Games, and done countless tournaments with USA Hockey. You won't find a more experienced or respected athletic trainer in hockey. Ray's a great guy, and seeing him lift the cup this June was awesome. Enjoy! Stanley Cup champion, the athletic trainer for the St. Louis Blues, Ray Barilli.
Thanks, Mike.
It must be quite a feeling. I can see that you're still smiling. Has that ended since the season?
Ended since the season. So one of my colleagues, when I was down at our trainers' meetings, called it a perma-smile. So it's definitely a permanent smile.
But it wasn't the only thing that's happened in the recent memory here, though, for you that's been really exciting.
Yeah, it was my youngest son, Ted, got married. And the story of that is pretty amazing.
He actually got married?
Well, or he knew his now wife, Connor, for a long time. They dated when they were in high school, 10 years actually. So one of the things that with the Stanley Cup was in the back of my mind, I knew that they were getting married. I knew what the date was. And it was after the Cup final. And after we take the team picture, they open up the Zamboni gates and the media and families can come out on the ice. So it's very emotional. My wife and my youngest Ted, we're in Boston for game 7. My oldest, Casey, is in law school, and he had exams, so he couldn't make it. But after we won, I gave everybody a hug and looked at Ted, and I said, you know, I'm hearing that the parade is going to be on Saturday. We won the cup on Wednesday. And so the parade was going to be Saturday, and that was the day that they're supposed to get married. And he looks at me and says, Dad, don't worry. We got it all figured out. We're going to move the wedding till Friday. And so he and his wife, Connor, moved the wedding to Friday. So we had all of our families coming in from New York and Florida and all over North America for the wedding. The kids got married on Friday. So instead of having 100 plus people in the church, there were 10 of us. There was no music. There was no flowers. There was no photographer. So everybody just used their iPhones. The maid of honor played the wedding march on her iPhone, held it up, and they got married Friday. And then Saturday morning, my oldest son had flown in for the wedding, and not knowing obviously that we're going to win the Stanley Cup, but we did the parade, which was just an unbelievable experience, and had the wedding reception after the parade. So with all family members in town,
I don't know if you could have had a better couple of days.
The timing was everything just kind of fell into place. I mean, just it's a sub-story of the season, how all of everything with our team fell into place, but it all fell into place with Ted and his wedding. So,
well, and what a great gal Ted's wife must be. Can you imagine switching the day around a couple days in advance?
No bridezilla here. She is phenomenal. And you know, the fact that she would move her wedding date, you know, to a day earlier and not have all the fuss and, you know, all the stuff that the brides go through, which I can't say that I'm that familiar with it, but I can honestly say that I'm very pleased the fact that they were able to make that accommodation for us.
You know, for players, winning the Stanley Cup's obviously the ultimate prize, but people don't take into account, though, for trainers, for equipment managers, for all the support staff. Is it just as big of a thrill for you guys to win it?
Yeah, I mean, it is. For me, this was my 24th season with the Blues. So, you know, at one point you don't think that you're ever going to get an opportunity to win the cup. We went to a couple of Western Conference finals and weren't on the winning end. And that cup just seems so elusive. And it's something that you never think you're ever going to win it. And then, you know, things happen in a season. All these little cogs fall into place and it allows the machine to start moving. And I mean, there's so many little, when you look back at the season, there's so many little things that fall right into place, and allows us to start winning as a team, and then allows us to make the playoffs, and then allows us to continue to win and to continue to move through the playoffs. And it was just, you know, an incredible culmination.
As a trainer, do you ride the wave of emotion like we do in the locker room throughout the season?
Yeah, I think we do. I think, and that's part of the process of becoming a professional and being able to control your emotions. You know, you One of the things that happened, as most people know, is in our series with San Jose, there was a hand pass and we lost that game. And Chief did a phenomenal job of pulling everybody into the locker room. And there's emotions all over the place.
Talking about Craig Berube, head coach of the St. Louis Blues, Chief.
Yep. So Chief pulls us in and he actually, you know, he said that the words that he said to the team were fitting. It was, you know, hey, the series isn't over. This is we're two great teams. We're the better team, but we're going to win the series. And we just got to stay positive and focused and don't let our emotions get too high or low. And I came out of that meeting thinking that was the turning point for me in that Western Conference series, was the fact that Chief had the confidence in our group that we were going to win the series. And I think everybody had that same feeling. And it was, you know, again, your emotions could have been all the way down, and we were able to bring everything back to a midline, to a neutral. And Chief did a fantastic job, not only with the players, but with the staff and his coaches and everybody. I mean, he was truly, truly a leader for us.
What I loved about it is that he didn't look for a cop-out to the referees, for an excuse, for any reason to look back at their own play.
Nope.
Other than to look forward, find a solution, move on. And you saw it with some teams in playoffs that they went the other way with that. And I mean, when you galvanize a team, it was almost like, even from the outside looking in, you could see it was just water under the bridge, go play hockey. And you look how the next game went. And you're right, that seemed like it was a turning point and a catalyst for the team to keep moving forward in playoffs.
That's exactly it. And credit Jordan Binnington, because, you know, Binner was, he was on fire. So, you know, that we knew that his confidence level was up, and everybody else's confidence level after Chief's talk in the locker room, everybody's confidence level was almost like, I'm not going to say like we won the game, but it was almost okay, we move on to the next game. And we flushed that game and we just moved on, and everybody's attitude the next day at practice was as if we had won the game. There was nobody dragging. There was no one with their lip on the ground. Everybody was positive, and that was, I think, a real turning point for us.
You've been a part of some really big stuff during your career, and not just in the NHL. You've done world championships. You've done the Olympics. Mm-hmm. How did those experiences compare to finally getting to a Stanley Cup final and then winning the whole prize?
Well, I did the Olympics in 98 in Nagano, Japan, and I did the Olympics in 02 in Salt Lake. And Herb Brooks was our coach for the U.S. team in Salt Lake, which was just a phenomenal experience to hang out with Herb in the Olympic Village. He and I would go to the dining hall and sit and talk hockey and just talk about players and people. And it was just an unbelievable hockey experience for me, learning experience, to be with somebody that's as great as Herb Brooks was. And then, you know, when you're in the Olympics, they tell you, and it's true, you don't win a silver medal, you lose a gold medal. And we lost our gold medal to Team Canada. They had a phenomenal team. We had a really good team, but they had really good players as well. I think Marty Brodeur stood on his head and was just a phenomenal goaltender. Mike Richter played great, but we just couldn't overcome Marty. And the Canada won the gold. And so I hearken back to those memories of the gold medal game whenever we would get deep into the playoffs. There's a calmness that actually comes about. You don't, for me, I wasn't, you don't get that emotional. You don't get that wound up. You stay on task. You think about, you focus in on what you need to do. You're running through scenarios in your head. You know, if this happens, what are we doing here? If this happens, what are we doing there? Making sure your supplies, there's a lot of things to keep your mind busy. If you don't keep your mind busy, then you'll just drive yourself crazy. Like you'll become an emotional wreck. And I learned that at the Olympics in the gold medal game. And I used that technique this year with the Stanley Cup final.
Do you think that, you know, being an athletic trainer, you have so many things going through your head, as you just alluded to. How do you keep track of that? You know, like you're in a position where you're actually almost an EMT out there. Mm-hmm. You're potentially at any moment might have to rush out and quite literally save somebody's life,
right,
or save a limb, or all these things that seem cataclysmic, but they can actually happen.
Right.
How do you train for that mentally?
Well, we train every year. We go over at our meetings. We hold emergency protocols and we review everything. We, you know, CPR and you know, Stop the Bleed, which is a new campaign that's out. We're involved with that. Emergency techniques. What's the latest techniques that are used to, you know, out in the field for the EMTs and paramedics to rescue people. And we apply those in a hockey setting. So you're right. I am the first point of contact for the players is if there is an emergency situation on the ice, I'm the first person that gets there. So, you know, you have to work on your skills. You're constantly reviewing them in your head because thankfully we don't have to use them a lot. And, you know, but you have to stay sharp. And part of it is a mental rehearsal, the same as you would be as a goalie thinking about the game and using your mental imagery. I'm doing the same thing, but I'm applying medical techniques to, you know, the hockey situation or the hockey world. So they're very similar. I mean, your mental imagery is key. So you're constantly thinking about things that you need to keep an eye on, things you need to do, equipment that you need to check, stuff that you need to look at, make sure that everything is in working order. It's just the same as a goaltender would, making sure his straps and his pads and his, you know, the strings and the laces and everything in his equipment is all up to snuff so nothing breaks. In my realm, I'm worrying about equipment. Making sure our AEDs have batteries, making sure the oxygen is full, making sure we have a tracheotomy kit, making sure we've got all this other equipment in case of an emergency. So you're constantly thinking about that. We're always worried about something happening, but as long as you're prepared and you're mentally sharp, then things are good.
You've compared this a lot to goaltending so far.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the reason why I've always enjoyed spending time with you, because you've worn the pads quite a bit in your life. And you've got a son that's worn the pads. As we talked about Ted, he was a goalie also.
Yep.
Played through juniors.
Yep.
And myself being a goaltender, we always had that in common. But a lot of people don't know this about you, that you've been a practice goalie for the Blues on many occasions.
Been a practice goalie for the Blues. Mark Roof was an assistant equipment manager with us back when I first started. And Mark went in net, and I would also go in net. It was when Mike Keenan was our head coach and GM. When we had Grant Fuhr, who had a knee issue, so there were some days where we gave him a practice day and we would jump into net and play. And that, for me, it just kind of kept moving. And I would skate with the guys in August and get the pads on and let them shoot at me. And I think I was a good confidence builder for a lot of guys. but it was a lot of fun, good way for me to keep in shape. And also it gave me a better appreciation of the position. It made me appreciate the work that the goalies have to put in, the technique that's so important for goaltenders. And again, I kind of, my career in the NHL, 24 years, started with Curtis Joseph and John Casey. And has obviously worked up to Benny Binner and Jake Allen. So I've seen a lot of goaltenders in my day. But I think, you know, the one thing with goaltending is that I got a good appreciation for by playing is the work and effort that has to go in the technique and the style, the goaltending style, if you will, and how the game, the position of goaltending has evolved over the years is just, you know, is incredible. You know,
in the time frame that you're talking about from when Curtis Joseph came in,
yeah,
jumping around in the net to where we are now, where everybody's so detailed in their approach. And you would especially know firsthand, having such a good goaltender coach here in David Alexander, who's detailed down to the finest degree.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing how far we've come with it. Do you feel like you have a special relationship with the goalies, though, because you've done that?
I think, I try to foster that relationship with the goalies, because I think that besides a goalie coach, I don't know that there's anybody else on the staff that thinks about the goalies the way that I think about the goalies. I look at them from a biomechanical aspect and how they make saves and the positions that they put their bodies in and what potential injuries they might suffer because of the goaltending style. You know, we're talking about more hip problems nowadays than we've ever. And I think that's part and parcel due to the butterfly save selection.
And how young they're doing it now the repetition of it. Yeah.
And I think there's also, from a medical standpoint, there's a correlation between, you know, what we used to see with kids playing baseball and elbow injuries and young kids having to have Tommy John surgery and young goalies having more and more hip problems. I think that we might have to look at something down the road as far as Hockey Canada, USA Hockey, and how we let young goalies play the position. And also how we screen goalies, from an NHL level when we draft kids. You know, we are looking now at certain things in different anatomy and biomechanics as to, you know, are we going to see problems with this particular goalie down the road? So, but I think I've always had a soft spot for goalies. I've always I consider goalie coaches probably some of my better friends. Mm-hmm. And we've had some really great goalie coaches here. I remember when I first started with Mike Keenan here with the Blues, we didn't have a goalie coach. We went for a number of years without even having somebody that looked after the goalies. And Keith Elaine was our first goalie coach with the Blues. Now he's the head coach at Yale University. And we've had a great run of people that are goalie coaches. And you mentioned Dave Alexander. And I think Dave was really instrumental in us winning the Cup this year. After Mike Yeo had gotten fired, first day here, we're sitting here at the Mills, our practice facility, and Chief had asked Dave to give his presentation. Dave had a PowerPoint that he wanted to show the team, and Chief allowed him to show this presentation that he had. And it was really interesting in the fact that as a goalie coach, normally they look from the goal and they look out. Dave turned it around and looked as a goal scorer, how are we scoring on goalies and how are goalies getting scored on? And he has an unbelievable amount of data and unbelievable amount of video. And he was able to put together this presentation that he gave to the team. And it was basically, how do we score in a nutshell? And a lot of times I see players come out of meetings and they've got a glazed over look. And sometimes their comments, you know, this is over 24 years. They look at you like, I'll never get that 15 minutes back.
Yeah.
And
Where's
the coffee? Yeah. I need another warm up kind of thing. Yeah. And Dave, after Dave's presentation, there was a spark that happened in our guys where guys were sitting and talking about this presentation long after the presentation was over. And that was one of those things that I'd never seen that before. And it was something that Dave was able to produce with our forwards and with our D in showing them all these things. And Chief, it was all part of this buy-in. And Chief was bought in and Dave was bought into Chief. And it was like one of the first cogs for me this season that fell into place. And there were many more, as I mentioned, that we kind of go through to win the Stanley Cup. But there's not a lot of people that know about this presentation that Dave did, but I think it was instrumental.
What time frame was that? January?
It was literally the day after Mike had gotten fired.
Late December.
Yeah. And we were here at the Mills, and it was, whenever somebody gets fired in an organization, the next day it's kind of a quiet day. There's not a whole lot of fanfare, and there's a lot of introspection and people thinking about what they've done and how are we going to change things. And And again, Chief was like, said to Dave, hey, why don't you show that presentation, go over that. And it just sparked something in our team. I really think it had a lot to do with our turnaround. There was a lot of factors, but I think that was part and parcel.
I played for Dave in Syracuse, and we mm-hmm. went to the Calder Cup Finals.
Yep.
And we had the same thing.
Yeah,
we had all that scouting, pre-scout, how do we score on this guy? And for me, as I was doing some media stuff through writingfornhl.com, I was seeing trends in the Blues play, how they were putting shots on goal, how they were scoring. In the back of my head, I'm thinking, Dave's smiling upstairs right now because I know they're listening to him and it's working because there's a trend to this stuff. Probably makes me happy that I didn't have to play you guys when I showed up in Philadelphia in early January. And I get to tell people that I was there for Jordan Binnington's first start.
Yep.
Was a shutout. It was against the Flyers. I was opening the door on the bench, behind Carter Hart. But that's something that people don't realize about goaltending coaches, though. They don't just take care of your own goalies. They're very much involved, if they're allowed to be, in doing pre-scouting and teaching your players how to score, how to improve their skill set.
Yeah. And Dave brought that to us. And I think that's a critical subset of things that we did was what Dave worked on with the forwards and the D in teaching us how to score. And I think the guys took to it. I think it was great.
We've talked about your relationship with the players a lot here, but you have to have a relationship with the coaching staff, with management. Does it ever put you in a tough spot sometimes trying to bridge that gap between the two?
Not really. I think as long as you're honest and open with everybody and everybody understands that you have their best interest in mind, I think that's pretty straightforward. And that's kind of what I live by is, you tell people, tell them all the information straight. You give it to them. You don't sugarcoat it. You explain to them, what the goal is and what we're trying to do. And as long as you're honest and you care about people, it's not usually a problem.
Yeah. Has the evolution of this changed a bunch over the years? Again, you talk about mid-90s when you've got Keenan here. Were you the only trainer on staff?
Yeah.
Compare that with today. What do you have for support staff now with the St. Louis Blues?
So when I first got hired by the Blues, again, Mike Keenan hired me. He was the head coach and GM.
He was everything.
Bob Berry was a coach with us, and Ted Sater was a coach with us. Ted still lives here in St. Louis, and we visit whenever we can. It was myself as really not the head trainer. I was the only trainer. So I was the athletic trainer.
You were the trainer.
Yeah. And
right.
Terry Roof was our head equipment manager, and his son Mark Roof was the assistant equipment manager. And then Mike had hired the first massage therapist in the history of the Blues, whose name was Jeff Cope. We called him Weird Al because he looks like Weird Al Yankovic. But that was
with
a nickname.
With the curly hair and everything?
That was, actually, Holly gave him that nickname.
Oh,
but
guys giving him outfits at Christmas time?
No, he was kind of out there, but he did a great job. And it's a difficult position for some massage therapists because they have to buy into the hockey culture, which is, you know, the late nights and moving gear and helping hang up sweaty stuff. And so Weird Al bought into that. And so it was really just four of us. It was Terry and Mark, myself, and Weird Al. And, you know, there was no strength coach. There was no other ancillary support people. And now you look at it, and we've got, Joel Farnsworth is our head equipment manager. Rich Matthews is our assistant, who came to us from New Jersey Devils.
Right. Former head guy with the Devils.
Yeah.
I was there, actually.
Yeah. Yep. Andrew Dvorak's our truck driver. And then we've got another locker room attendant, Mark Evans, who used to be a security guard for us at Enterprise, and now he helps us out with day-to-day. And then we've kept the massage therapist. Steve Squire is our current massage therapist. He lives in Rochester, New York area. And now I have an assistant, Dustin Flynn.
Who I had in Peoria.
Who you had in Peoria.
Awesome guy.
Yep, great guy. And we've had some, you know, again, it was really Doug Armstrong who brought in the assistant position for me.
And you had Mike Hannigan, too, and I had in Las Vegas.
Hannigan was my first assistant. And then,
this is why it's called 6 Degrees, right?
Yeah. and then Chris Palmer was my other assistant who was in Peoria for a bit with us. And when we had our club there, and now is at Middlebury College in Vermont. I've had three assistant athletic trainers. And I think, you know, over time, your question was kind of like, what's the difference now? There's so much more administrative work that has to be done. There's as probably with every business, there's more paperwork that needs to be done. There's more phone calls. There's, you know, as technology improves, there seems to be more work.
And the documentation of every injury is so thorough now, and it's all digitized. I'm sure you spend hours plugging it into the computer.
And that's a lot of time and effort that we do. Right. So, but we still have to maintain what I like to call is being on the factory floor. And Dusty and I work really hard at making sure that we're available for the players and we're not sitting behind a computer punching in data points. And we need to make sure we get out there and we're interacting with the players as much as we possibly can, and letting them know that we're there for them. So that's the biggest difference. You know, now we have a full-time strength coach. We have our former assistant strength coach is now the head strength coach with the New York Mets. He left us in mid-season. We have two strength coaches on staff. We've got the massage therapist, two athletic trainers, you know, four equipment managers. So the staff size has increased, and there are teams who are actually on the low side. There's teams that have more than that, you know, full-time people. They might have a physical therapist full-time. They might have, all kinds of different subspecialties and larger equipment staff. So we're actually on the smaller end of the staff scale.
I've seen teams that I've been on, because I've been on a lot, three, four, I mean, ART specialist, massage guy, physio, it's amazing the support staff. And that's just people who are on payroll, but even on game days, then you get an influx of even more people.
Right.
And you touched on how Weird Al had to get acclimated to the hockey life a little bit.
Yep.
And I want to touch on that because people don't understand the hours that you guys put in, especially on the road. So let's talk life on the road for a little bit here.
Okay.
Give us a typical trip for the St. Louis Blues. You show up at the airport,
so a typical,
load in.
Yeah, a typical trip will usually start here at the Mills, and we'll have a practice day. And it'll either be a full practice or an optional practice, depending on what Chief wants to accomplish. And then we'll leave, and we're we're fortunate. You know, my first couple of years, we used to fly commercial with TWA, and we would, you went to the airport, you went through with everybody else, and security wasn't as tight back then, but it was still pretty tight. And you flew on a commercial flight, you hoped to get a window or an aisle, and you got to the city, and you moved on.
If now, you're a rookie, you got no chance.
Now you got a middle seat.
If you're a rookie, you're instantly given your window ticket to the veteran. You do that to kids now, and they look at you like you got three heads.
Yeah,
they can't believe it, but that's the way it used to be.
Yeah. And fortunately, at the NHL level, a number of years ago, everybody started to charter flights. So I'm extremely spoiled in the way that I travel, or the way that we travel, and the fact that we fly on a charter jet, and it's. Well, there's always some hiccups, but it's much better than, having to travel regularly through the airport and with the airlines. So we are spoiled in that fashion. But so we would usually get to the plane. Equipment staff takes the gear, the hockey gear, and loads it on our equipment truck that's taken plane side, loaded in to the plane. We jump on. We'll fly to the city. We'll land. We'll unload the equipment from the plane into the equipment truck. And every team has an equipment truck that meets you plane side and then takes your gear to and fro. So I will either go usually with the team. Dustin will sometimes go with the gear. Sometimes we'll kind of go back and forth. We'll split it up to make it less painful. But one of us will go to the hotel, make sure the players are all taken care of. The other will go to the rink and help unload gear. And the amount of gear that we travel with now is, I'd probably say about 9 or 10 times more than what we used to travel back in 94, 95. The amount of equipment that is carried is astronomical.
Right.
So in any event, we unload the gear and then, basically, if it's if we're going to practice in that city, we'll have a practice. If it's going to be where we have a game the following day, we get pretty much the evening to get together, have dinner, spend some time, call the family, FaceTime if possible, and then get ready for the next morning, which would be a game day. We usually get up around 5:30 or 6, have breakfast, head over to the rink, and basically wait for the coaches and the players to show up. So, and then the game is played at 8 o'clock. And then 7 or 8, and then we basically pack up the gear, we move it to the next city, and we unpack it. So those are the late nights, is after a game when you're unpacking gear. Typical when we land here in St. Louis post game, after a game, it's usually 2 o'clock in the morning. By the time you get home, it's usually 3:30, maybe 4, and then you're back up at 6 a.m. to come back to the rink to get ready for practice day or game day, whatever. So the hours are incredible. You find that you're just picking up sleep whenever you can. I've gotten really good to be able to sleep on the plane. Mm-hmm. So you catch a few winks and maybe take a little pregame nap before the players show up for the game to try to get yourself mentally prepared for the game and also for the road. So it's a tremendous amount of time. The amount of time that we spend traveling and setting up and moving gear and getting stuff ready for the games, it takes up a fair amount of the day.
You learn how to be really efficient in life, though. I'd imagine how to be an efficient packer.
Yeah.
But you're really on call all the time, though.
Right.
I mean, this is a full-time job times 10 in that if somebody needs something and they're an NHL player, they're calling you at any time of the day, right?
That's correct. Yeah. So my phone's on, 24/7, 365, including Christmas. So, which, is the one day we get off during the season. But actually Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, but still.
Thanks to the PA.
Thanks to the Players Association. Yeah. But, there's still times where, I've had calls where guys have cut themselves and done stuff, and you're working on those days too. There was one year that we had a player was cutting a bagel and sliced his hand, and it was in the morning, and it was right when my kids were opening Christmas gifts. So you can imagine how thrilled my wife was when I had to take off and go take care of that person. So that was when I didn't have any assistants, so it was just basically me. But there's, you're constantly on call. My phone never gets turned off. If a player texts in the middle of the night, I'm going to try to wake up and answer it. And I take the phone calls all the time. And it's not just players, it's coaches and it's management and ownership or whoever needs the help. That's why I'm here.
What's most rewarding when somebody, I from the outside looking in, I would think that if somebody has a major injury and you can get them back in the lineup faster.
Yeah.
Is that true to say, or is it maybe something different that they really get back at 100% and feel?
Yeah, it's not necessarily faster because, obviously we want to get back. We want players to get back, as quick as possible, but as healthy as possible. And again, no one makes it through a full season without some sort of minor injury that you're constantly dealing with. So if we can eliminate all the major injuries and try to get everybody as healthy or as close to 100% as possible, then that's the goal. The thing that makes me the most proud is really when a player sustains a major injury and they go through the rehabilitation process with me and with the staff, and they come back and they score a goal, or they make a huge save for a win, or they do something that, helps their team succeed. That to me is just, that's, I've got a smile on my face. And it may be a loss. We actually may lose the game, but I know that player has come back. He's worked so hard and he had his opportunity and he scored, or, he has worked hard and he made an unbelievable amount of saves, but yet we still weren't able to win the game. But it was, a personal best for saves or something. So those are the moments that really make me smile.
Well, because you've had a hand in that. You can see a tangible force that you've had to be able to get somebody through something and power through it and get to a personal goal and do well.
Right. Well, it's being able to help somebody reach that goal.
Right.
And, the players put in the work for the rehab, and all I do is I guide. So if I'm able to guide somebody and work them, help them through a situation when they get hurt psychologically, they become depressed or they get down. It may not be full depression, but they're not feeling well about themselves. They're not feeling well about their situation. And to be able to help them work through that and to get them on the ice and to be able to score a goal is, or have success on the ice for me, that's what it's all about.
What can be frustrating from your perspective?
Well, there's a lot of things that can be frustrating, but
it's a really general question.
Yeah,
but let's say, in terms of a rehab, what can be frustrating if something's not going right, or
if a player's not responding as the way we thought that they were going to mm-hmm. respond. So, and again, because it's a business at the NHL level, there's expectations about when a player is going to return from an injury. So, if they're not able to hit those marks, that becomes very frustrating because the media and the public are expecting this player to be back at this time. And through no fault of the player or no fault of anybody else, their body just isn't responding as we thought.
Below public might take 8 months to recover from this, and they expect a pro hockey player back in 3 weeks.
Right. So we've had players tear their anterior cruciate ligament and return to play. And, you're reading in the media or I'm not online, but people will tell me that, they're bashing this player because they think he's slow and he's missed a step or whatever. Meanwhile, they don't understand that he's put in an unbelievable amount of time rehabbing himself from this major knee surgery that some people never recover from. But yet, he's considered to be a half step slow. And then by the end of the season, he's back up to full speed or better. And those are the situations that I can go look back and smile at and say, I was able to assist that player in getting better and to be able to get a new contract, to be able to help have team success. That's what it's all about.
Has medical technology and training technology evolved to the point, though, that it is really predictable how most people are going to respond to treatment or rehab?
I think over time, as with any type of medicine, it continues to improve. Sports medicine, I think, because we're on the forefront of, the news, and you see it, you can turn on the television every day, you're going to see sports on TV and I think there are expectations of this player has injury X and they're only going to miss this amount of time. So you're kind of under the gun to make sure that happens, but also you're wanting to try to make sure that the player doesn't re-injure himself and now he's out longer, or, that he does something that adversely affects his career. Like, to me, that's one of the things that keeps me up at night, is to think that, that there's something that a player has done with his injury or coming back from his rehabilitation that has the potential to cause him, the loss of being able to play, which in a professional hockey player's career, that's his money making. That's his income earning. If I worked on somebody who laid bricks or you know, put down carpeting or was a carpenter or something, and I adversely affected their performance that they could make money, you know, that's what keeps me up. So for the players, it's, you're constantly thinking about how can I get them back as safely and quickly as possible. Again, because it is a business, and every game that they miss is money out of our ownership's pocket. You know, the players have guaranteed contracts, so they do get paid when they're injured. It's not like the NFL, where a player was injured and there's an injury buyout and you never see that player again. Mm-hmm. We need to get that player back healthy, and we need to get him back playing to the level that he can participate at.
Strength training has changed so much, even since I first started playing 14 years ago as a professional. But I'm going to lay one on you here, and I want to see how you feel about it. Do you think that strength training has had positive, negative, maybe nothing impact on injuries in the game, whether there's been more or less, more severe? Do you think it's made any difference at all?
I think what happens is, I do agree with you. I think that strength training in hockey specifically, that there are things that we've done in the past that maybe have led to injuries. You look at the stationary bike. When I first started, we had a stationary bike for every single player. That was a Mike Keenan that we had, and everybody had to have their own bike.
He was a big VO2 test guy.
Big VO2 test guy, and a big bike after the games and whatnot. So we used to have, you know, everybody would get off to take their gear off and get in the gym and get on a bike and pedal.
Hollywood, too?
Yeah.
Hollywood?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, everybody. Yeah. Well, maybe not so much Holly, but okay. Yeah, pretty much almost everybody. But, and then we started to see all these abdominal injuries, which are called sports hernias. There's a bunch of different names for them, but the collective term is a sports hernia. And we started to see a large amount of these sports hernias come about. And we kind of were trying to figure out why these sports hernias were happening. And Dr. Michael Brunt, who practices here in St. Louis, is one of the preeminent surgeons who takes care of this problem. And Dr. Brunt and I have published some chapters and books and papers looking at abdominal injuries and rehabilitation from abdominal injuries. And what we surmised is, and what we think is, that the amount of biking that hockey players were doing was leading to these abdominal injuries. And teams started to move away from the biking. And we've seen a decrease in abdominal injuries due to the players not biking as much as they used to. Now, I can tell you that anecdotally. I don't have any scientific proof to that. But when we started to decrease the amount of bike riding that the players did, we saw a decrease in the abdominal injuries. And when you query the players who do have the abdominal problems, some of the times it's from, yeah, they've been doing an excessive amount of biking, or they were trying to lose weight and they did a lot of biking, or they were working on footwork and foot speed and they were doing a lot of biking and they had this problem. So I think that to answer your question, I think some of the things that we've done in the past have led to some injuries. And I think strength and conditioning is an area that keeps improving, like medicine, every year. And the more people train a certain way, we start to see different injuries with, you know, the way people train, whether it's CrossFit or whether it's, you know, high intensity training or whatever. I think if you do it in moderation and you do it, you know, where you're cautious about overuse injuries, I think that you can decrease the injuries. The other thing we've seen too is the practices that we've had in the past. Again, I harken back to Mike Keenan era. Mike was one of the first coaches that I ever worked with that we only practiced 20 minutes or so. And I think that led his team to not have as many injuries. I've worked with coaches where we've practiced 45 minutes or more, and it's been high intense, and we've seen more injuries. So I think getting quality practice time, and that's where Chief is phenomenal with our team. He understands what our team needs at that particular time and is able to perform that in practice. But we're not grinding guys on the ice just to grind guys. Mm-hmm. We're not trying to work a paycheck out of them by having them skate sideboards. You know, we're being smart with the amount of energy that we're using on the ice, and we're allowing players to recover. You know, that's the other big thing that's I think strength and conditioning is looking at is the recovery aspect of players.
When you get a goalie on the table versus a regular player on the table, when you're working on their body, can you tell biomechanically and the way that their muscles have grown and developed that they're a goaltender strictly from having them there? Do you think that it's that different of a training and a building of the strength? Or are our bodies much more similar to players than I would even think?
I think goaltender bodies nowadays are much more similar to outskaters. I think when I first started 24 years ago in the NHL, our goaltenders weren't as they weren't as physical specimen as they are now. And I think part of that has to do with training and the evolution of off-ice conditioning and such. But I would say that goaltenders now in the NHL are in as good a shape as outskaters were 20 years ago, if not more. And the other thing, too, is that we see everybody comes in shape now.
Right.
Like, no one uses training camp to get into shape. Everybody maintains a level of high condition through the whole 12 months. We used to see a lot of guys back in 20-plus years that would – season was over and they would step off the conditioning wagon and, basically have to recondition themselves at training camp. Those days are over with, though.
Didn't Keenan kick Fuhr out one year?
Yeah, Grant came in a little bit.
And then you had to bring in Bob Kersey, I think.
A little
right?
bit heavy, yeah. And Bobby was brought in to Bobby was actually brought in to keep an eye on Esa Tikkanen. So when Esa had a shoulder injury, and we needed somebody to keep Tiki in line. So
the ultimate irony of that though is I think Grant went and played 80 games that year.
Yeah. and Grant is again, arguably the best goaltender I've ever worked with, and has just a phenomenal personality, great person to hang out with and be with. He would come in every day and we'd sit and have a coffee. And I learned so much from Grant. He's such a great person. He actually was in pretty decent shape. It's just at that particular time, he'd let himself go right before camp. And Mike was a little upset with his weight. And Mike was a little ahead of his time with that kind of stuff. He was very, very motivated to make sure the players were in the best condition possible.
When you get a guy coming in either as a free agent or on a trade, do you guys do your homework in advance? And then if you get through around the league and all of a sudden you find out that this guy's kind of been labeled as a high maintenance guy, do you just take a deep breath and start clean and hope that that's not the case?
High maintenance guys are it's interesting. High maintenance guys know what they like. And that's what you just have to realize is that they know what they like and they know what it takes for them to be successful. You can't be a high maintenance guy and not be successful. If you're not successful and you're high maintenance, you're not in this league for very long. So high maintenance guys are usually very successful, meaning that they've either won the Stanley Cup or they've got an Olympic gold medal or they've got some sort of winning pedigree. But you can't be high maintenance and not be a winner. I mean, those two things don't play. As far as trades and stuff, sometimes we will talk to our colleagues before a trade. Sometimes almost all the time we'll talk to them after the trade, just to kind of get an idea of what what the player is looking for, what their expectations are, if they've got any prior injuries, different equipment that they might need, day to day stuff that they need to have performed in order for them to perform well.
There is a little bit of teamwork aspect to that with other trainers throughout the league, though, right?
Yep.
I mean, I'm sure even during games, there has to be protocol amongst you guys. If something goes wrong on the ice, I'm going to cover for you. How does that work? Do you talk before games, summertime? Yep. Do you figure those things out?
Yeah, it's interesting. Not a lot of people know that the athletic trainers in the NHL and basically all of pro hockey are pretty much all friends. I mean, we're all colleagues. We're all...
PHATS members, correct?
Yeah. PHATS, which is the Professional Hockey Athletic Trainer Society, is a professional group that we all belong to, and we have a meeting every year, an annual meeting. This year it was in Austin, Texas.
Good place to be.
Great place to
be.
Big
fan of Austin.
Yep.
Love my time there.
A lot of fun there. It was a great city. The hospitality was phenomenal.
Best street tacos you can find anywhere.
I didn't partake, but I'm told that.
Digressing here, I could go forever about Austin.
Austin is a great town, and we have a woman who's directs our group, and she threw out Austin, and really only a couple of us had been there because there's an American League team in that region, and so I'd never been to Austin before, and so for me it was great to see Austin and be in that culture. It was it's definitely someplace I'll visit again. But we meet annually every year, and we've gotten to the point where now the National Hockey League comes to our meetings, the NHLPA comes to our meetings. We have the equipment managers at our meetings. We've got all the NHL team physician is at our meetings. And we do all of our education there. And that's the purpose of it. It's an education society. It's not a union. It's not a, you know, anything else. It's purely an education society. We collect funds, and we have scholarships and a bunch of other things. But this is where we talk about all of our emergency procedures. We talk about what the latest is, and it's strictly a hockey meeting. There's no talk about women's volleyball or, you know, what's going on in the world of soccer or football or anything. It's just specifically all the talks are hockey-specific, medical presentations, and strength and conditioning coaches are there too, so there's strength and conditioning presentations. But it's an avenue for all of us to sit, talk, hot stove, be collegial, and communicate. Collaborate and communicate. And so part of that is you know, we have set standards that everybody's expected to meet. And some of those are emergency standards. Other ones are day-to-day standards. Like if you're coming into my building, you're going to know that these pieces of equipment are going to be available. And
here's your reference phone numbers, all the emergency things you need.
Yeah, all the stuff that you need, all the supplies and equipment is going to be the same in each city that you go to, which makes your job easier as an athletic trainer. So, and what we do is, you know, again, we try to foster as much collegial attitude as we can, and we'll go next door and visit. If I'm the home team, I'll come over and visit you as a visiting athletic trainer, make sure you need anything, check in with you, help you get whatever you need to take care of your players. Because at the end of the day, it's not about, you know, the visiting trainer myself battling. The players are the ones that are going to win the game on the ice. And so there are some young trainers that have to learn this the hard way, and the fact that, you know, they think it's them versus us, and if I don't help them, you know, we'll win the game. But what happens is you know, what goes around comes around, and you need help in St. Louis, and, you know, it's something serious, and all of a sudden, you know, you there's a little quid pro quo that goes on. So,
or you need that hot dinner reservation, or you're not getting.
Yeah, or you need to, you know, you need a chiropractor to see
ticket, or
you need a chiropractor to see one of your players, or you need a dermatologist to look at something that has, you know, gotten way out of control, and, you know, all of a sudden it's, you know, well, you know, maybe that phone call takes a little bit longer if you're, you know, not collegial,
right,
and helping each other out. So
there's a lot of common courtesy to it, right?
It's a tremendous amount of common courtesy. And that's what it is. It's a matter of us being professionals and working together. And that's what we try to foster with that. So I was president of the PHATS Society for a number of years, past president. And now I'm a member of the Joint Health Safety Committee, the combined committee of the NHL and the NHLPA. And I represent all of PHATS on this committee that makes policy for health and safety for the NHL. And I'm proud to be on that committee. If there's some great people, you know, Bill Daly from the league, Julie mm-hmm. Grand, Steve Fear, Maria Dennis at the PA, John Rizos is the medical director for the PA, Winna Maywissa is the medical director from the NHL. And Gary Dorsheimer is the physician in, with the Flyers, is the representative for the team doctors. So, again, we set and make policy regarding, you know, everything that happens medically within the National Hockey League. So it's a big undertaking, and it takes up a lot of time at the PHAT. So I wasn't able to get out for the street tacos as I was hoping to be able to.
Hopefully they catered in a little bit of barbecue.
Yeah.
You talk about emergencies, and I think about your time with the Blues, and the first one that came to mind was a really big one, and it was Chris Pronger.
Right.
He was hit by a puck, essentially in the heart, and you'd be much better to walk us through what happened, what the protocol was, how the rehab went, but it was a really scary moment. And I want to know from your perspective what that was like, how you process that. Does it kick right into gear? And when you show up on the scene, to know immediately what you need to do, how does that work?
Yeah, so we were playing Detroit at Joe Louis Arena. And Chris was in front of the net, and I want to say he was cross-checking somebody, and actually was getting a delayed penalty. And Mironov, the defenseman for Detroit, shot the puck on net. Grant Fuhr was in goal. and Chris took the puck right underneath his shoulder pad. So as the puck came towards him, he kind of lurched up, which raised his shoulder pads up on his shoulders and exposed his chest wall. And he took the puck directly onto his chest wall, kind of right below the, or on the left side next to his sternum. And he took two or three steps and he collapsed. At the time, I was on the bench and I saw the play happen and I saw him fall. And I wasn't really sure what it was because I thought that he blocked a shot, but I didn't see exactly where he blocked the shot. So I jumped over the boards and ran out to him. And when I got to him, he was on his back and he was cyanotic. So his lips were blue. I pulled his eyelid back and looked at his eye because he was unresponsive and his eyes had rolled back, you know, up in his head. And he was totally unresponsive. And that's not like prongs. Anybody who knows Chris knows he responds quickly in situations. So normally with a little bit of anger. But so he wasn't mad that he got hit. He was just unresponsive. And again, trying to gauge his responsiveness, I took position at his head. And because I'd seen him get hit with a puck, I took his helmet off because I knew that he didn't have a head or neck injury that we needed to worry about. Again, he wasn't wearing a visor or any kind of facial protection, but took his helmet off and then tried to establish consciousness, and he was just turning blue. So his lips became more and more blue. And it was at that point where I started to run through all the things in my head about the emergency procedures. And again, this was during the playoffs. So we travel with our physicians in the playoffs. Dr. Matt Matava was out with us on that trip, and Dr. William Bierenbaum was with us on that trip. So internal medicine and an orthopedic surgeon. Dr. Bierenbaum had come out to the ice, and I started to take Chris's pulse at his neck, and I couldn't find a pulse. And I was like, well, I must be doing this wrong. So I took a pulse again, and there was no pulse. And then I can't believe I'm not getting this pulse. Like this, I know I'm in the right spot. Right. So nothing, you don't realize it. The athlete has no pulse. So I'm checking it for
that
third.
That doesn't seem fathomable, right?
Right. Because it's not something that you would normally, that we normally don't see. So Dr. Bierenbaum arrives on scene and I'm like, we've got no pulse. So I check his pulse. Dr. B grabs his wrist, I believe, and is checking for a radial pulse, and we've got no pulse. So we're cutting off his jersey, about ready to do CPR. And all of a sudden, you can just see that he comes back. And, you know, whether it was a little thump to the chest or whether it was he just somehow he converted. And all of a sudden, his lips became pink again and his eyes came back and he opened his eyes and was focusing on myself because I was right over his head and reached up and grabbed me. And we basically then put him onto a gurney and brought him to the ambulance. Now, this was before the days of AEDs being all over the place. So now, we carry an AED with us wherever we go. This is before AEDs.
And those are defibrillators. Right. That's what my friend Rich Peverly was lucky that there was one in the rink for him. Or maybe it had been mandated previous that effectively saved his life in Dallas or against Columbus one night.
Right. And that was before them. Right. So no one had one of those in the rinks. We didn't travel with one. We basically didn't know what they were.
Because they're mandated now. They have to be everywhere.
Yeah, now they're mandated.
You see them in youth rinks now. Everywhere.
You see them in youth rinks. You can see them in the airports. You can see them in any kind of public space. And that's one of the things I've taught my kids and is to keep an eye, to try to take a look and see where all that equipment is. Where is the AED in case you ever need it? That's a good point for everybody, is just to kind of take a look around and know where they're at so that if you do need it, you know where to run to grab it. If we had an AED, we probably would have put it on Chris. There's no question about that. And why he converted, we're not really sure. But he was diagnosed with commotio cordis by Dr. Barry Marin in Minnesota, who's kind of the preeminent expert on commotio cordis. And Chris, my understanding, is one of the few individuals to have been hit in the chest wall, suffer commotio cordis, and converted and lived. So we were extremely fortunate. The other thing we were fortunate was that there was no AED in the ambulance in Detroit. And if we had needed one, there wasn't one available. We just would have done old-fashioned CPR and tried to get to Henry Ford Hospital as quick as we could. So there was a lot of things that fell into place on that day. We're fortunate for Chris's sake that he recovered and recovered quickly. He was followed by Dr. Patricia Cole here in St. Louis, and he wanted to play the next game. Like, that's the kind of competitor Prongs
Everly
is.
Everly was like that. Yeah. What's my next shift? No, yeah. You're not playing for a little while. So.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know, Chris checked out everything. We did a Holter monitor on him, and everything came back to the cardiologist, you know, that they would allow him to play, and he played. So it's one of those situations that, you know, the stars aligned that day. And it was probably because Prongs is such a mean SOB that he wasn't going to let things happen. And I don't know what, but he, you know, thankfully we had a great outcome that day.
I can't imagine what went through your head when you showed up and no pulse, anything, and completely out of the realm of what you were thinking could have happened.
Yeah. Didn't expect it.
On a much lighter note,
yeah,
I'd really like to ask you about the art of running on the ice.
Okay.
Because fans in St. Louis and fans across the league see you go tearing out there with the towel.
Yeah.
Very little slippage.
Very well, sometimes.
What's the key to this?
The key to it is to have a pair of shoes that are completely flat on the bottom.
Do you wear the spikes?
No spikes.
Okay, so and you have perfected the slide into the player then.
Yeah, so it's I'll say that at the start of the period when the ice is fresh, that's the most difficult time to run on the ice, as you would probably think. And then as the period goes on and there's a little bit of snow, then the ice becomes really easy to run on. And as long as you have shoes that have a flat, completely flat sole. I used to wear a pair of – they were made by a company called – and they were a replica of a 1920 baseball shoe. And it had an absolute flat bottom to it, which was almost like Velcro running on ice. And then they discontinued making them. I couldn't find any more sizes, pairs of my size. So I switched over to Asics makes a shoe that, again, has a completely flat bottom to it, almost as flat as this tabletop. And that's what allows you to run on the ice surface. If you run in regular running shoes or any kind of sole that has any kind of ripples to it or whatever, then you're just going to fall. So
you need maximum traction.
You need maximum traction and some knee bend. And
does it give you celebrity status around town?
No.
Come on. Somebody, people have to recognize you out every now and then.
No, I don't get recognized that almost ever.
Well, you can keep a nice low profile.
Yeah,
that's nice.
I can stay under the radar, which is fine.
If you had to give advice to anybody who was looking to get into your field as a profession, what would it be?
It would be to first take a look and see what your family life is like. What do you want to have? Do you want to have a family? Do you want to have kids? What does your spouse or future spouse think of your being an athletic trainer? That's the one regret that I have in doing the job that I do is the missed time from my family. And if you've got a family support system that will allow you to do to miss time, then I would say go for it. Like, but if you're somebody who's really family centric and you really want to spend time with your kids and that part's really important to you, then being an athletic trainer in the National Hockey League is not where you want to be. We have a high divorce rate amongst my colleagues. My wife is Kathy is phenomenal. She went to school as an athletic trainer. Realized that there couldn't be two athletic trainers in the family, so she went back and got her nursing degree. But she understands the time commitment that's involved with working, doing what I love to do. And she allows me to do that, which is great. And then my two boys who we alluded to earlier, Casey and Ted, I missed everything with those guys. Like I didn't hit a single, you know, school play. I missed all of their road games because they both played hockey and baseball. I missed all their road games. I never went on the road with them. I was the practice dad. I would show up and take them to practice, and that was about it. And caught a couple of games when they would play at home, but they were the ones who suffered probably the most of my job and me not being around at all to see any of their events. So that's the toughest part. That's the part that I tell people who, you know, because I get student athletic trainers that walk up and they're like, hey, I want your job. And I'm like, you can have my job if you think you can handle a family life, because that's the most difficult part of my job.
You need fair warning for it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So in terms of schooling for it, best route for someone to take?
It's just is to be involved in athletics. If you're in high school, you know, and you have an athletic trainer at your school, shadow them, help them out. Then the NATA, the National Athletic Trainers Association, has a listing of schools that offer education programs to become an athletic trainer, and to make sure that you go through the correct program so that you're able to sit for the national certification exam and become an athletic, you know, certified athletic trainer through the NATA. And then if your interest is in a particular sport, it's, you know, networking with people in that sport, getting to know them, go to meetings, talk to them, sit down. You know, a lot of the hires that I've done in bringing people into the profession are, you know, people that I know that they're good athletic trainers because they went through good programs, but I know that they're better people. And so, you know, that's really, you know, how are you as a person? Are you able to communicate? Are you able to, you know, are you going to be upset that you've got long working hours? Are you going to, you know, those are not the people that we're looking for in the profession. We're looking for people that can kind of come in and be seamless with the hockey culture and are able to work with everybody in the organization. So that's really my best advice for anybody. And then also look at some sub certifications. You know, there's strength coach certifications. There's opportunities to become a licensed massage therapist, which our profession has moved towards as more hands-on therapy than modalities or, you know, ultrasound and STEM kind of rehabilitative techniques. So find, you know, not only just become an athlete trainer, but also get some other subspecialties. ART, you mentioned earlier, is a good one. I've got that. And you're always continuing to learn. The day that you stop, you think that you know everything, that's the day you're out of the profession.
Well, Ray, you're now a Stanley Cup champion. So what's next for you? What are you looking forward to in the next several months, years here?
You know, I that's a great question. Because
you still get a huge smile on your face when you hear those words, as you should.
Yeah, I still can't believe it. I mean, I was sitting watching television last night, and there was a commercial that came on, and Doc Emmerich's voice was in, and it's an advertisement for the shirts and the hats and, you know, Stanley Cup champion, St. Louis Blues. And just to hear Doc say that, it's unbelievable. I did have goals set when I first started in athletic training, and I've ticked off all the boxes. So I guess it's to win another cup. You know, it's my former colleague with Dallas Stars, Dave Supernaut. He won the cup in 99, and we were doing the Jerry Bruckheimer celebrity tournament in Vegas. And I asked him, I said, you know, what's it like to win the cup? And he goes, it's unbelievable. And I concur. And he said, I want to win it every year, but I also want everybody the opportunity to win it once, because it's just an unbelievable feeling. And, you know, when you lift the cup over your head, when I did in Boston, the weight that fell off my back, you couldn't see it on TV, but there was a huge weight on my back that fell off. And it was, like I said, it was one of the last boxes that I wanted to have ticked. I wanted to work the Olympics, and I was fortunate to do two of those. I wanted to work the World Juniors. I was fortunate to do a number of those. I wanted to do a World Championship. I was fortunate enough through USA Hockey to do a bunch of those. I did two Canada Cup tournaments. One being Canada Cup in 91, and then the latest, the World Cup. So, I mean, I've had lots of opportunity through USA Hockey and all my friends at USA Hockey who are phenomenal. The late Jim Johansson was phenomenal to me. Yeah, great guy. I love JJ. And I think about him a lot. You know, I've been given a lot of opportunity to work with a lot of great people. I work with Bob Johnson. I work with Herb Brooks. I've worked with, you know, Joel Quenneville, Mike Keenan, Ken Hitchcock, you know, Chief. I've worked with some of the best coaches, some Hall of Fame coaches, Hall of Fame managers, you know, and a ton of Hall of Fame players. So I'm really fortunate.
One last question.
Yeah.
Will you keep Gloria on your playlist for the rest of your life?
Probably I'm going to have to. I mean, the story.
My daughter wants it on hers now because she heard it so often through playoffs.
The story of you know, again, it's one of those things, those little cogs that just kept, you know, just fell into place. You know, we talked about Dave Alexander earlier. We, you know, Layla Anderson, the Gloria song. There's so many little things that have to fall. All these little cogs have to fall into the machine in order for the machine to start moving. But then when they do, it just, the machine takes off on its own. And that's really what happens during the finals, is it takes on a life of its own, and you really just, you're just helping the machine move and enjoying the ride. And that's what I've been doing, just trying to enjoy the ride.
Thanks for listening to 6 Degrees with Mike McKenna. Please make sure that you like, comment, leave a rating, subscribe, whether it's iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, anywhere that you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.